From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Extreme cold and heavy snow are straining power grids around the country again today, and Texans are still bearing the brunt of it. More than 4 million homes and businesses in the state started the day once again without power. Houston police say at least two people died from carbon monoxide poisoning after running a car in a garage for heat. And without power, the Houston Chronicle was unable to put out a print edition of its newspaper today. Joining us now is Dan Cohan. He's a professor at Rice University who studies climate and the energy grid. He's in Houston, where temperatures were in the teens this morning. Dan, welcome.
Thanks, Peter. Good to be on the show.
Well, and first of all, what a thing that is happening to you all there in Texas. How are you doing? Have you lost any power?
We've been very fortunate and have a bit of survivor guilt that the power and heat have stayed on here, but so many other Houstonians and Texans are without power right now. So it's really been a tough disaster for the state.
Well, right. I mean, we've been hearing from people in Texas who've described how they lost power dozens of times yesterday, on for a few minutes, off for an hour, over and over and over again. How unprecedented were these rolling blackouts and demand for power in Texas over the past day or so?
Yeah, it's unprecedented to have blackouts this severe and this prolonged and over so much of the state. When we usually think of blackouts, it's when a line goes down in a neighborhood and a small area is affected. Or, of course, sometimes we have outages because hurricanes hit. But to have an outage like this in the wintertime from a freeze event is really unprecedented at this scale.
Is it as simple to say that there's just too much demand and the grid can't handle it? Because we're seeing some other sort of wild things. That, for instance, wind turbines are freezing in West Texas, and that natural gas wells in Oklahoma and Texas are frozen, and that's led to a shortage of natural gas. So what's behind all this?
Right. The demand is only one piece of it. Demand is about 10% more than we had thought the peak might be. But the real story is that the supply hasn't been there. What the state calls firm supply, the supply from mostly from natural gas and coal, has had huge outages that more than a third of the supply they were counting on went out because a lot of supply in Texas isn't prepared to handle very cold weather, and because the natural gas gets needed to heat our homes and businesses, and so power plants are on the back of the list. We had a lot of the natural gas power plants go down.
And can you blame any of this on the turbines that have frozen up?
The wind turbines are a tiny part of the story here. So come up maybe one or two units short of what was expected. But the other sources, the so-called firm sources, the natural gas and coal and nuclear, have come up about 30 gigawatts short of what was expected. So it's really mostly a story of natural gas power plants not coming through when we counted on them the most.
I know some people have been wondering like how this could happen at this scale, because look at Texas. This is typically a state that's known for its heat, not for its cold. And in the summertime, it can be over 100 degrees across this huge state for months at a time. So how can Texas handle that but crumble when it comes to cold weather?
Right. So I think there are two things here. One is that we're seeing just how interconnected our natural gas and our electricity systems are. The second thing that we're seeing is that the grid mainly plans for the hottest summer afternoons. And really all the planning goes into that. And in fact, a lot of our plants are down this month getting ready for that summer peak because we didn't expect to be having such a peak event right now. And so you put those two situations together and Texas just wasn't prepared enough for a deep freeze event, unlike anything we've seen in decades.
Yeah, many people probably also don't realize that most of Texas is actually on its own power grid, whereas the rest of the country, many of the states are very much interconnected. Did that present Texas with any unique challenges in this emergency?
Right. The very isolated grid that we're on, being really an island, means that when it comes to electricity, whatever happens in Texas stays in Texas. And that really hurts us at a lot of times in the windy seasons when the weather is mild and our wind turbines are generating lots of power. That means they can't send it to other states that might need the power. And now when we have a freeze or when we have a heat wave in the summer, we're not able to bring in much power from other states. So it's a system that has its advantages, but that comes to hurt us at times like this.
Yeah. You're a professor at Rice University. Your class was canceled today due to the weather, which I'm sure is very rare for you there in Houston. But it does seem, in the spirit of education, that there are a lot of lessons to be learned here. What are you taking away? I mean, what is the lesson that you wish you could teach to your students today?
Right. I really wish I was with my students. I think what we're seeing is how interconnected our energy systems are, and the need for resiliency and planning for events that are outside the norm. And it's so hard to predict what the next weather risk or what the next climate risk will be. And so we need to think about how do we design our energy systems to be prepared for a wide range of risks.
Dan Cohan, professor at Rice University in Houston, who studies, among other things, climate and the energy grid. Thank you so much for your time. Bundle up, stay warm. Good luck to you.
Thanks, Peter. Appreciate it.
The impeachment trial is over, but the investigation into the January 6th insurrection continues. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the task of Congress is now to get the truth of what happened, and they're now establishing an outside independent commission to investigate. For more on the significance of this commission, let's bring in Julian Zelizar. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And Julian, this is actually the first time we've had a chance to speak with you since the end of the trial over the weekend. How do you think this will go down in history?
Well, I think the record that was provided by the House managers was very damaging to the former president and the GOP. It made what happened seem even more dangerous and even more brutal. And it put a record in the history books about what happened and how the president was involved in this. So it's a story about both the abuse of presidential power, the radicalization of the GOP, and all of that will be an ongoing lesson from the trial, even though he was acquitted.
On that issue of abuse of power, I mean, critics of former President Trump believe that he was not held accountable. What questions do you now have regarding future presidents being held accountable for their actions?
Well, the Senate had a chance to take a bold stand as to what happened, and not enough Republicans did. So it creates a problem. It creates a bad precedent. And we keep seeing how when extreme action happens and no one does anything, the action just becomes more extreme. That's the story of the insurrection. So the question is, do other mechanisms go to work? Does the court system provide accountability? Does a commission or the Department of Justice provide accountability? And finally, do voters provide accountability in the 2024 election?
On this idea of commissions, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, of course, is going after accountability. And in addition to investigating the facts of what happened as part of this commission's role, she also wants to look into the preparedness and response at the Capitol. What should that commission focus on, in your view?
Well, I think there's a lot of questions about why there wasn't more preparation in the days leading up to the certification. I think we now know that the warnings were there, and yet for some reason the warnings weren't heeded. So from anything to the basic security parameters that protect the Congress while keeping it an open institution, a house of the people, we need to just understand why the security wasn't sufficient. And why warnings weren't listened to. And I think Pelosi is committed to doing that, in addition to the role of the former administration in how this all happened.
How challenging do you think it will be to keep this commission bipartisan?
It's very challenging, but not impossible. Commissions have the capacity to do this kind of work if you have the right people on the commission in sound fashion. I think a harder thing will be the response to the commission. That will certainly be politicized, but we can't let that stop the production of knowledge. There's too many unanswered questions that this commission has to deal with.
And when you say the response to the commission, the response to the commission's findings will be politicized.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, Speaker Pelosi compared this new commission to the one formed to investigate the 9/11 attacks, if we remember that back then. What are the lessons from the work of that commission that can be used today?
Well, a good lesson is that the 9/11 commission produced reorganizations in government in terms of how we gather and organize our intelligence. It also provided a best-selling narrative that many Americans heard about, at least, if not read, about how this happened and mistakes that we made or the government made in the days leading up, in the years leading up to 9/11. But there were also negative lessons. There were problems if the commission really looked at everything, if there were conflicts of interest in the 9/11 commission where some commissioners held back from a full accounting. And those lessons are important too. We need a full, honest, and transparent accounting of how this insurrection happened. And then the commission can do what the 9/11 commission did, but even better.
Oh, yeah, the conflicts of interest point in part. Hopefully we will learn our lessons from this 9/11 commission. Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. As always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't we take a breath and listen to some music? The Planets by British composer Gustav Holst. While he was writing it about 100 years ago, World War I was raging and a flu pandemic was breaking out. And in the uncertainty of the times, astrology was on the composer's mind. What you're hearing here is a section called Jupiter, the Bringer of Jollity, which was in short supply at the time, and perhaps now. Our music opinionator Fran Hoffner is here to discuss the Planets. Fran, welcome. And jollity, I didn't even know that was a word. I had to look it up. What should
we
know?
It's a fun one. It makes you want to like use it in conversation more.
And I think I'm going to in this conversation. So tell me more about Gustav Holst. You point out that he was a Virgo, and actually that matters in the context of this music.
You know, this is like such a meticulously well-researched piece of music, especially for its time period. I think only the sort of, you know, grounded, particular Virgo would be able to compose such a piece like this. And Holst was like a huge astrology head, so it makes sense that this is, you know, his most famous piece. Gustav Holst is a British composer who comes out of England in the late 19th century. You know, he was composing a lot of very English music, a lot of marches, things that would sound, I think, almost too traditional and austere to modern ears. But The Planets is what launches him not only to like fame in England, but international fame. It was one of those, you know, world-renowned pieces of classical music as it sort of crossed the Atlantic into the United States.
Well, Holst was a reader of British author Alan Leo, who was actually called the father of modern astrology. So, I mean, connect the dots for me, if you could. What was Holst trying to do in this 7-movement orchestral suite as it relates to astrology, or even the planets?
I think he wanted to use sort of, you know, the map of space to actually represent something close to, like, the stages of life. It's crazy to think in after, you know, decades of science fiction that something about space would feel so profoundly new. But this was like a really daring project to do. And I think we knew so little about space that the idea of someone making art around it felt really brave and interesting and strange. And I think there was a general hunger for things that didn't sound like or weren't based on things we already knew about.
Well, and he started writing The Planets at the start of World War I, so it's no surprise, then, that he starts with Mars, the bringer of war. Let's listen. Fran, that's very militaristic. It almost feels like I'm in a movie.
It's super cinematic, and it's really tense. There's no way to relax and listen to Mars. I think the snare drum and the timpani and all the really percussive elements, you know, using auxiliary percussion was kind of new for when this piece debuted, and so using those, you know, really evokes the sound of war. These are war-centric instruments.
All right, well, speaking of percussion, here's Mercury, the winged messenger. Thank you. So, Fran, I mean, there really is some pretty wild percussion in that music right there. You actually use the F word to describe it in your blog post about this song. But I also understand that you played it as a student musician. Why do you think Mercury is so strange?
I think Mercury is often the planet we use to symbolize chaos. It has a frenetic, unpredictable nature. You'll see sort of astrology heads blame random events on Mercury being in retrograde. We're always supposed to fear Mercury in retrograde because that's sort of when crazy things happen. And I think this particular movement is really capitalizing on that chaos. It's an absolute treat to play as a percussionist to get that many notes.
What is it like? Yeah. Is it tough to play?
It's definitely tough, but I think any percussionist will tell you that they love having more notes than, you know, the one big timpani roll and otherwise just sitting in silence for 12 minutes, as it can often be.
Hmm. So how popular is Holst amongst musicians, especially students? I mean, is this something that if you play classical music, you're bound to come across this at some point?
I do think that a lot of youth musicians, you know, high school and college orchestras will play The Planets. The Planets has this enduring appeal because each movement is so tonally different. There's something for everyone, which makes it really popular, I think, for younger musicians. The Planets really seems to be the one that people gravitate towards, you know, no pun intended.
Yeah. Well, speaking of gravity, let's get a little further out into space with Saturn, the bringer of old age. Holst wrote The End of the Planets after Igor Stravinsky premiered The Rite of Spring, which changed classical music forever. Would you say that Saturn is reflective of that?
Yeah, I think Saturn and the two movements that follow have this weird atonality that you see reflected in a lot of Stravinsky's work. Stravinsky was really pushing the boundaries of what classical music could sound like. And I think what's so cool about The Planets is that it starts in sort of a more conventional, familiar, classical tradition. And then, you know, the further you get out in the solar system, the more bizarre it is, the more unknown it feels.
Yeah. Well, we're going to skip right past Uranus and we're going to go right to Neptune, the mystic with an eerie choir. Let's listen to that. Tell us about Neptune. I can almost picture floating out there in space in the darkness, like looking at Earth in the distance, the very, very far distance.
Yeah, the choir really generates this ethereal sound, and I think it feels very far away when you listen to it. It reminds me a lot of the music from like older Disney films. You know, this one is cinematic, but in kind of a spooky way. Where it's almost like you can feel the presence of Neptune without being able to like locate where it is. For some people, I think they find this last movement very calming. I think it's so creepy and eerie to listen to.
Well, I can't get this far out into space without talking about, well, it's not a planet anymore, is it? But Pluto, actually not discovered until 1930, a decade after the planets premiered. He might have had fun with Pluto, though.
Oh, definitely. Pluto has a lot of personality. I mean, I think it's interesting that we have this artistic record of what people thought of the planets back then compared to what we know about space now. That the Neptune movement is so, I think, eerie really speaks to the unknownness of space. And, you know, 100 years later, that we still, there's still huge pockets of space we know nothing about. I think that's part of the enduring appeal of Holst's music, is that it just understands that we're never going to know everything that's out there.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the legacy of this music is?
Oh, I think it is like the perfect gateway from romantic era classical music into more modern classical music. It's taking this like programmatic storytelling, it's building a narrative over these parts, and then, you know, it's going into a lawless land, as a lot of modern classical music goes.
Yeah, so Fran, we're gonna leave one more time, taking a listen to Jupiter. This section has been called heroic and inspiring to people. So here that is. Let's listen. Hoffner, Here and Now's Music Opinionator, thank you so much for taking us on this journey through space with Gustav Holst. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from HomeTap, the smart way to access your home's equity and pay for life's expenses without a loan. With HomeTap, receive cash in as little as 3 weeks and use it for anything you'd like, from paying off debt to funding renovations and more. Plus, you don't have to deal with monthly payments or interest. Learn more about HomeTap and get a personalized estimate at HomeTap.com.
Decades before the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, Marcus Garvey attracted millions of followers with a message of Black self-sufficiency and Black nationalism in Africa.
For our Black History Month special series, The Seismic Influence and Complicated Legacy of Marcus Garvey.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Protests against the military coup in Myanmar continued into today, and a new charge was filed against the ousted civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi. This all comes as the country's army is also repeating its promise to hold new elections. Let's talk about what's going on with Lucas Myers. He's the program associate at the Wilson Center's Asia program, and he joins us now on Skype. And Lucas, what do you make of today's developments?
I think it's rule by law, not rule of law. And what I mean by that is that the new charges against Aung San Suu Kyi appear designed to ensure that she remains in detention indefinitely. The previous charges were based, you know, upon the illegal importation of walkie-talkies and were clearly quite short-term, while these new charges are based upon supposed violations of coronavirus restrictions under Myanmar's natural disaster management law. And under this, she could face 3 years in prison, which is more serious than the previous charges. And with the election announcement, I think I'm very skeptical that the military plans on handing power over to a civilian government. The new elections are unlikely to be as competitive or as fair as the November 2020 result that led to the coup this year. So I imagine that this announcement is meant to reassure the public, but I don't think the military is serious.
How is the government responding to the protesters who were out on the streets again today?
The military seems to be slowly escalating its crackdown. Now, in previous instances of protests against the military, in 1988 and 2007, the military used significant violence to curb protests. And I'm pretty concerned that the military could escalate even further if its curfews and demonstrations of force don't work. There have been reports of live ammunition fired at protesters, and as well as rubber bullets. And this, if these protests continue, there's a risk that the military will consider escalating even further, which would be a very dangerous situation.
Aung San Suu Kyi made a brief virtual court appearance today. Won't fresh elections be meaningless, though? You kind of touched on this, if the government continues to detain her.
Exactly. The similarity to the situation after the coup in Thailand in 2014 is quite striking. Mm. 2014, the Thai military overthrew their government and then promised new elections. Well, those new elections happened in 2019, but the military changed the constitution and ended up returning to power because the elections were unfair and unfree. Interestingly, last week, the prime minister of Thailand, who was actually the leader of the 2014 coup, reportedly received a letter from the Myanmar coup leadership asking for support. So I think the similarity is quite apparent there. And I don't think that these new elections are going to be any sort of competitive contest.
Speaking of support, how has the Biden administration, if at all, responded to this?
You know, I think it's going to be a hurdle, you know, for the Biden administration. They've talked about coordinating with allies, but there is some reluctance from some of our allies, such as Japan, that are wary of imposing sanctions on the military and risking their quite substantial economic investments in Myanmar, as well as pushing the Myanmar military further into China's orbit. And so I think going forward, the U.S. is going to have limited options for increasing pressure on the military beyond the sanctions that they've already rolled out.
Mm-hmm. Lucas Myers is the program associate at the Wilson Center Asia Program. Lucas, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
At least three people are dead in Brunswick County, North Carolina today after a tornado damaged dozens of homes late last night and knocked out power. It's another result of the wild winter weather that is wreaking havoc across the country. Reporter Ben Shockman from member station WHQR in Wilmington joins us now. Ben, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
And we're seeing pictures of homes in rubble, cars flipped over, but reporters weren't immediately allowed into the area. What are you able to find out about the damage?
Sure. So the about three towns in the Brunswick County area, Carolina Shores, Sunset Beach, and Ocean Island Beach, were all badly hit, about 50 houses destroyed early in the morning between 1 and 2 a.m. Some reporters did manage to get on the scene and take some photos. And what we're seeing now are drone photos, and they're fairly sobering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the tornado, it struck, as you say, in the middle of the night. So what kind of warning did people get about this storm?
Essentially none at all. There was a warm front moving through, which is kind of odd compared to what the rest of the country is experiencing right now. But the National Weather Service confirmed that this developed very quickly and it became very strong very quickly. The first tornado warning, which is more severe than a tornado watch, was issued around 11:40 on Monday night. And that was about 10 minutes after the tornado had already struck down. And I should also say that this is not usually our severe weather season. Tornadoes usually occur between March and August here with a peak in May. And so this was in every sense unexpected.
Yeah. But tornadoes do happen there along the beach in North Carolina.
They do happen along the beach in North Carolina, especially in conjunction with hurricanes. They were very destructive during Florence and Isaias. And of course, tornadoes can happen at any time of the year, but this is not usually when we see them.
All right. So it's been a couple of hours since this storm hit. As you said, the destruction is pretty robust there. What's going on today in terms of more damage assessment and cleanup?
So the tornado cut a very sort of precise path. I mean, you see one house completely obliterated. It looks like it's been turned inside out next to another house that looks untouched. So there's a lot of going through and double checking for structural damage, checking for gas leaks. A lot of these neighborhoods have been evacuated so those safety checks can be done. And so utility companies can get in and get power out, because at one point there was north of 35,000 homes without power.
Wow. Is everyone accounted for at this point?
Everyone is accounted for. That was a concern early in the morning. Local fire departments and rescue teams were on search missions. And currently, aside from the tragic death toll and the people who were injured, everyone is accounted for.
All right. Well, I'm just wondering what is happening for people who have lost their homes. There must be quite a few of them. Are they getting shelter? And I asked that question in the context of this pandemic, where sheltering with a lot of people can be dangerous.
Absolutely. It's a good question. Thankfully, or maybe not, but for better or worse, Brunswick County is prepared to handle countywide evacuations for hurricanes. So there is certainly room for something that is devastating, but thankfully much smaller scale than, say, something that happened during Florence or Dorian.
Yeah. All right. Ben Shockman of WHQR in Wilmington, North Carolina, where a tornado tore through Brunswick County, North Carolina, last night, leaving three people dead at least. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Depending on where you live, you may have noticed in your Sunday paper a full-page ad by Facebook calling on the need for updated internet regulations. It's a surprising message from a company under intense scrutiny for allowing conspiracy theories and misinformation to run wild on its platform. The ad gives us a window, however, into possibly how the social media company may be trying to get ahead of new regulations that could soon come out of Washington. Let's bring in Elizabeth Dwoskin. She's Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hey, Tanya.
Okay, so these new ads by Facebook say in part, quote, "We support updated internet regulations to set clear guidelines for addressing today's toughest challenges." Is this a window into how they're trying to take control of the narrative?
I mean, as many people in Washington know, and as people very familiar with Facebook's thinking have told me, you know, no company wants more regulation than it can actually handle. You know, they're only going to, until it can hurt their business. They want regulation until it can hurt their business. But Facebook has been saying this, I think, for the last year and a half. Mark Zuckerberg has been pretty strident about it. He always mentions it in his public comments when he's on, you know, talking with Wall Street analysts. And the point is, you know, it's easy enough for them to say they want more regulation because it puts the onus on the politicians, especially in this country where we have a very strong First Amendment, to try to figure out what to do about all of these problems that are coming out of social media, from hate speech to misinformation. And one of the questions that I would like pose to you and to anyone listening to this show is, you know, when something like a violent comment appears online or misinformation about vaccines, what should be the responsibility of the tech company to take it down? If they say it's against their rules, and what should the government do essentially to force them? Should they make them pay a fine? Should they make them be able to go to court from people who were injured by those comments? Should there be a time limit, 24 hours, that they have to take it down? So, like, we should all really think about what is reasonable if we're all going to continue to use social media. These things happen.
Right, those,
and I'm not an apologist for it. I'm just being real.
Right. Those are all big questions and important ones to be asking. You're right. As users of Facebook, as those who follow Facebook, absolutely. You know, I want to ask you about something else, because Facebook is doing a lot of things, including talking about this idea of updated internet regulations that benefit the company. Something else Facebook is doing, they're reducing the amount of political content appearing and users' news feeds. This, of course, comes after the company's COO, Sheryl Sandberg, tried to deflect blame for the Capitol insurrection into smaller social media sites like Parler and Gab. Do you see this as a significant shift in how Facebook sees its role, or is this basically just a temporary adjustment?
I think this is a significant shift, and it's a tacit admission of all the... It's the company's way of saying without saying, yeah, we've caused a lot of problems. Now, they would disagree with that if I said it to them right now, but just look in perspective. There were a lot of measures that Facebook took during the election period, which they said were temporary. It wasn't just reducing political content. It was, they said that they were going to pause group recommendations. They said that they were going to pause political advertising. They used the word pause, and they said they were pausing it because it's this time of uncertainty, and essentially we don't know if our systems can handle it. All of those things, Tanya, have been made permanent. That means their system cannot handle the way society is right now.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Politico reported last week that House lawmakers are in talks to get more testimony from Zuckerberg, as well as Twitter's Jack Dorsey, and new hearings on Capitol Hill as soon as next month. So it doesn't look like Facebook is going to avoid this scrutiny. How do you have insight into how the company is planning to weather the Biden administration and the likelihood of new tech regulation sometime in the next few years?
I think the fact that Congress and the Biden administration have essentially come out of the gate with, you know, particularly Congress with a new round of hearings, it says that This is maybe this kind of scrutiny, which they were going to expect. I mean, Biden himself said that he thinks that the law, the Section 230 that you and I have talked about on the show before, the decades-old law that essentially shields these internet companies from responsibility for what happens on their platforms, he said himself that should be scrapped and it needs to be updated. So again, there's a lot of questions about who can update it, but you know there's a Democratic majority in Congress, however slim, and there are enough Republicans that also want the laws to be updated as well. So I think there's a lot of momentum for this. And then the fact that you're seeing them announce these hearings to come out of the gate, for me, it's a little boring. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm like, okay, Dorsey and Zuckerberg
yes.
testified a lot before Congress. What new are we going to
I'll
hear?
Have to cut you off here, Elizabeth Dwoskin. We'll have you on again to talk more about this. Elizabeth Dwoskin from The Washington Post.
The huge winter storm that's cutting across the country is causing delays in COVID-19 vaccine distribution for a number of cities and states. It is a setback after the number of people getting a dose in the U.S. had been steadily growing. Eventually, there will be more than two vaccines available. And Brett Dahlberg with IEEE Spectrum explains more of the science behind what's out there and what may be on its way.
Pfizer and Moderna are the only two companies with COVID-19 vaccines that are authorized for emergency use in the United States. But there are many more under development, both here and around the world. And what usually takes years is happening in months.
The speed of vaccine development has been unprecedented.
Players race to find a COVID-19 vaccine at record speed.
Record time.
One of the fastest scientific achievements in modern history.
Broadly, there's two types of vaccines under development. One injects the stuff that causes an immune response directly into the body. That's the traditional way of doing it. It's what we use for flu or polio or measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines. The other uses the body's own machinery to produce the protein that we need to recognize in order to fight off the virus. So let's start with the first type, the traditional way. Just because it's been around for a while doesn't mean it's outdated.
So it is an older technology. It goes back to the 50s, but can be very, very effective.
Dr. Mark Mulligan is the director of the Langone Vaccine Center at New York University. He says developing this type of vaccine is one of the most reliable options. Using this traditional approach, scientists take the virus that's causing the sickness, render it inert, and then inject it into our bodies. The body commits the shape of the inert virus to memory, so if the actual live virus appears, the body can quickly mount a defense. Mulligan says this type of vaccine is predictable and stable and doesn't require super cold storage. But growing whole viruses can take weeks, and you have to be really careful when handling them. So now, scientists are starting to look at another, newer method that uses just part of the virus.
Remember, at the outset of the pandemic, we didn't know what would or wouldn't work. And so many different approaches were put into development.
One of these approaches is called protein subunit vaccines. Under an electron microscope, certain proteins on the novel coronavirus kind of look like they stick out from the virus's core. Those are called spike proteins, and the human immune system is really good at attacking them if it knows what they look like. Dr. Dana Mazzo at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York says it's a lot faster to manufacture these proteins than it is to grow full viruses.
You sort of think of like this, these huge vats growing lots of proteins.
She says at this point in the process, the proteins are in a viscous liquid form.
A liquid or a goop, being the technical term.
Once they're made into a vaccine, they're injected through a shot and work basically the same way as the whole virus vaccines. The protein subunit vaccines furthest along in development are from Novavax in the U.S. and Vector Institute in Russia. So those are the two traditional vaccine types that inject harmless virus parts straight into the body to build immunity. The other kinds of vaccine, the newest technologies, assemble those virus parts inside the body.
Kind of like taking over the cell as a factory for producing the vaccine.
That's Jeff Ulmer. He spent 30 years working on vaccines for a variety of pharmaceutical companies. The type of vaccine he's talking about uses genetic material, either DNA or RNA, to give our own cells instructions on how to make the spike proteins that other vaccines simply inject. He says it sounds more complicated, but in some ways it's actually a lot simpler. It's the technique that Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, and Johnson & Johnson are all using. And Ulmer says this genetic method can adapt a lot faster to variants of the virus.
They have the potential to markedly streamline and simplify vaccines research and development.
That's because growing viruses or proteins in a lab requires not just unique blueprints, but also unique assembly.
Every new product that you make that way, basically you need to start from scratch.
On the other hand, giving our own cells the blueprint for the virus proteins means they can move right to the assembly stage. Partly because these types of vaccines are so new, scientists are encountering concern that they're modifying our own DNA. They're not. Dr. Naheed Bhadelia says the genetic material in the vaccines doesn't linger in our bodies or become part of human DNA.
It's almost like someone sending in a Snapchat, a disappearing image of the virus to your body. And I think that's a good analogy because that's what it is. It's a snapshot that gives your body a way to develop a memory.
Bhadelia is the medical director of the Special Pathogens Unit at Boston Medical Center. She says these new vaccines are fast to produce and powerful at building immunity. But they're often not very stable. They need careful handling and really cold storage. But she says that could change as scientists get more familiar with them.
I hope future technology allows us to sort of potentially get these vaccines to a point where they're even more accessible, you know, as some of the more traditional technologies.
And the federal government says each of these different vaccines has to meet the same standards for safety and effectiveness before it's rolled out to the public. For Here and Now, I'm Brett Dahlberg.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.